content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the December 2021 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from Education Week. This article is entitled, How Can We Honor the Victims of School Shootings? Listen to Students. On the 9th anniversary of the Sandy Hook Elementary School tragedy, a mother speaks out. By Nicole Hockley, December 13, 2021. Nicole Hockley is a co-founder and the CEO of Sandy Hook Promise and the mother of Dylan, who was killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School tragedy on December 14, 2012. At the start of this month, we experienced the most fatal school shooting since 2018, when 4 students were killed and 8 wounded at Oxford High School in Michigan. Schools are seeing violence surpass pre-pandemic levels. There were more than 30 school shootings in 2021 alone, which have left dozens of children dead or injured. These figures don't include the devastating ripple effects on entire communities that have been ripped apart, lives forever shattered, and parents left with a lifetime of agony. Time may pass, but the wounds never heal. Next year will mark a decade since my own son, my beautiful butterfly Dylan, was gunned down in his first grade classroom. Since then, I've dedicated my life to finding ways to help keep children safe. Research shows that empowering students, listening to them, and taking their concerns seriously, and teaching them the warning signs of someone who may be a danger to themselves or others, are the keys to making schools safer. Starting the day before the shooting at Oxford High School, there were reports of concerning behavior by the alleged shooter. Tragically, those warning signs were not properly acted upon. Some students say they're more afraid of a school shooting than the pandemic, and district leaders nationwide are looking for answers. Policymakers and educators are eager to find solutions to school shootings and violence. Some are choosing hardening measures like metal detectors, cameras, and other equipment that makes schools look more like prisons than places of learning. Others are increasing active shooter drills and simulations. As district and community leaders gather to discuss their options, however, they often leave out a crucial voice, that of young people. Students are the eyes and ears of our schools. They are the ones who first encounter the threats of violence or suicide and see concerning behaviors, whether it's in the classroom, on social media, or in their communities. They are also the ones who can have the biggest impact on their peers when talking about violence prevention. Empowering students to become part of the solution can create not only real change, but a cultural shift in which more inclusive and welcoming environments are the norm, rather than the exception. Effectively engaging students to help keep schools safe begins with listening to their experiences and ideas. We must prioritize student voices in policy discussions and decision-making. Any effort will be fruitless if there isn't any co-creation or buy-in from the most important stakeholders who are most impacted by these decisions, the students themselves. The active shooter simulation law signed earlier this year in Texas is a perfect example of policymaking without meaningful student involvement. Simulations are different from drills. They mimic the scene of a shooting, from the realistic sound of gunfire to injured students and full police response. Active shooter simulations don't make students feel safer at school. Instead, students tell us they are traumatizing. In a recent national poll, 60% of teenagers reported feeling unsafe, scared, helpless, or sad as a result, not safe, protected, or prepared. In the national efforts to curb gun violence, it's often the survivors and victims who speak out for change. It's not by choice, but by circumstance. Policymakers want to hear from those most impacted by the issue. Why would debates on school safety be any different? Students know their peers and school community best. It's time we listen. Deeply. We can honor my son and the 19 other children and 6 educators who were murdered in the Sandy Hook tragedy, and the hundreds of school shooting victims since, by committing to co-creating school safety policies with our students. Without their input and ownership, any solution is destined to fail. This next article comes from U.S. News, and it's entitled, Lawmakers Demand Accountability from Instagram CEO. Lawmakers concerned about teen mental health are working on bipartisan standards for social media platforms that include oversight of algorithms used to target adolescents. By Lauren Camera, published on December 8, 2021. Democrats and Republicans appear in lockstep as they draft legislation to better police major social media companies to blunt the mounting mental health challenges among school-aged children. But it's unclear whether they can act quickly enough to contain a crisis that's been exacerbated by the pandemic and boiling over in real time. Our nation is in the midst of a teen mental health crisis. Social media didn't create it, but it certainly fanned the flames and it fueled it, said Senator Richard Blumenthal, Connecticut Democrat who led a Commerce Committee hearing Tuesday featuring the head of Instagram. The magnitude of these problems requires bold, broad accountability. In a political quagmire where partisanship rules, Blumenthal and Senator Marsha Blackburn, Tennessee Republican who acted as ranking member for the hearing, are collaborating on a bipartisan framework for how Congress could impose standards and checks and balances on Instagram and other social media platforms, including oversight of the algorithms used to target adolescents. The hearing took aim at Instagram, an offshoot of Facebook, which was recently rebranded as Meta. I'm frustrated because this is now the fourth time in the past 2 years that we have spoken with someone from Meta, and I feel like the conversation continues to repeat itself ad nauseum, Blackburn said about the pair's efforts, for which they anticipate introducing legislation in the new year. Quote, nothing changes. Nothing. Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, leaned on changes his company announced early Wednesday that include better time management options and more parental control, which are set to go into effect next year. I believe it's important that companies like ours are accountable to high standards, and I believe the most effective way to do so is to define best practices and best standards at the federal level, ideally, and to seek enforcement, Mosseri said. But members of Congress from both sides characterized the safety announcement as too little, too late, and far from robust enough to address the growing mental health crisis among adolescents. They also criticized what they deemed as vague commitments by Mosseri and said social media behemoths like Instagram could no longer be trusted. Blumenthal said his staff created a fake Instagram account on Monday posing as a teenage girl and within an hour was inundated with recommendations to follow accounts that promote anorexia and eating disorders. Senator Amy Klobuchar, Minnesota Democrat, said Instagram's priorities and the priorities of parents are, quote, diametrically opposed. But what Congress lacks in its current authority and ability to effect any type of substantial change in the near term, school districts across the country are grappling with in real time. Indeed, earlier this week, Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a rare warning about a rapid and concerning decline in mental health among children, underscoring that the crisis was emerging prior to the onset of the pandemic, which has only served to worsen the issue. It would be a tragedy if we beat back one public health crisis only to allow another to grow in its place, he said. This is a critical issue that we have to do something about now. We can't wait until after the pandemic is over. In a 53-page report Murthy released Tuesday, a Clarion call to action, he noted that 1 in 3 high school students reported persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness, a 40% increase from 2009 to 2019, and that suicide rates also increased during that time by 57% among youth ages 10 to 24. The Surgeon General also cited soaring rates of anxiety and depression, worsened by the pandemic, as well as concerns over gun violence, climate change, racism, and social and political conflict. We also have to recognize that kids increasingly are experiencing bullying, not just in school, but online, that they're growing up in a popular culture and a media culture that reminds kids often that they aren't good-looking enough, thin enough, popular enough, rich enough. Frankly, just not enough, Murthy told NPR on Tuesday. His warnings come on the heels of a report from the nonpartisan watchdog arm of Congress, the Government Accountability Office, which found an alarming increase in what it calls, quote, hostile environments in schools, including bullying, cyberbullying, harassment, hate speech, hate crimes, physical attacks, rape, sexual assault, and victimization. In recent weeks, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona has promoted ways for school districts to use federal coronavirus aid to provide additional social and emotional support to students, especially those from hardest-hit communities who experienced the most remote learning and often the most loss of family and friends from COVID-19. Until recently, school closures this academic year have been driven almost entirely by COVID-19 outbreaks. But in an effort to address mental health of both students and staff, many school districts are adding early dismissals to the school calendar or closing early for planned holiday breaks. Public schools in Richmond, Virginia, for example, are set to close December 20th and 21st to give students and staff, quote, a full 2 weeks of winter break to rest and recharge, physically, mentally, and emotionally, Superintendent Jason Camras said in a letter to the school community last week. This has been a particularly challenging year, he said. The pandemic has profoundly affected our students and staff, and we're only now seeing the full impact. Though physical health has been our focus for the past 20 months, I'm now particularly concerned about everyone's mental and emotional health. The school district recently reallocated $3 million in federal coronavirus aid to fund mental health supports. Please know that I do not take this action lightly, Camras said. But I believe we face an emotional and mental health emergency right now that requires us to think differently about this year. As for Congress and what it can do, Blumenthal said to expect bipartisan legislation in the near future. Parents are asking, what is Congress doing to protect our kids, he said. The resounding bipartisan message is legislation is coming. This next article comes from the New York Times, and it's entitled, Schools Are Closing Classrooms on Fridays. Parents Are Furious. This article is by Julia Hayward, and it was published on Wednesday, December 8, 2021. Detroit. Caitlin Reynolds, a single mother, was happy that her son, LJ, was finally settled into fourth grade after a rocky experience last year with remote learning. Then, on Wednesday, November 17th, an announcement. Detroit Public Schools would close its classrooms every Friday in December. There would be virtual school only. On Friday, a follow-up announcement. School was also canceled starting that Monday for the entire week of Thanksgiving. This time there would be no online option. You need to take the kids back out again, Reynolds said. How is that not going to be harmful to these students? After a few months of relative calm, some public schools are going remote or canceling classes entirely for a day a week or even for a couple of weeks because of teacher burnout or staff shortages. At least six other school districts in Michigan extended Thanksgiving break, and three districts in Washington State, including Seattle Public Schools, unexpectedly closed on November 12th, the day after Veterans Day. In one instance, Brevard Public Schools in Florida used leftover, quote, hurricane days to close schools for the entire week of Thanksgiving. In Utah, the Canyon School District announced that all of its schools would go remote one Friday a month from November until March, equivalent to more than a week of school. A few of these districts have closed with very little notice, sending parents scrambling to find childcare, as well as summon the wherewithal to supervise remote learning. Beyond the logistics, many parents are worried that with additional lost days of in-person school, their children will fall further behind. School districts cited various reasons for the temporary closings, from a rise in COVID-19 cases to a need to thoroughly sanitize classrooms. But for many schools, the remote learning days, an option that did not exist before the pandemic, are a last-ditch effort to keep teachers from resigning. They are burned out, educators said, after a year of trying to help students through learning loss and working overtime to make up for labor shortages. Battles in the classroom, from mask mandates to debates over critical race theory, have also taken a toll, said Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, the country's second biggest teachers union. What you hear from teachers is that it's been too much, she said, and they're trying the best that they can. These temporary closures, though, may only hamper relationships with parents at a moment when tensions in many districts are already high. Because of school cancellations last academic year, Reynolds, who works at a University of Michigan research lab, had already run out of paid time off. Her mother was able to watch her fourth grade son last Friday. But now she is scrambling to make sure someone else can be home with him every Friday this month, or lose hundreds of dollars from her paycheck. School fights and other outbursts from students led district leaders at Reynolds Middle School in Fairview, Oregon, just east of Portland, to cancel classes from November 18th until December 7th. They gave parents 2 days' notice. Are you kidding me? Said Missy Kisselman, the mother of Sophia, an eighth grader there. I mean, are you kidding me? Kisselman, who was working out of her living room as a county case manager, said it was, quote, nearly impossible for her to help Sophia, who has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, with her schoolwork. I feel like if the school knew that they were already understaffed starting this school year, it should have just stayed online, Kisselman said. Stephen Padilla, a district spokesperson, said the school was using this time to reflect on its safety protocols to, quote, ensure that we will not have to return to short-term distance learning in the future. In Portland, Oregon, the teachers' union is proposing early release days for high schoolers after they return from winter break. Elizabeth Teal, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, says her union is receiving an alarming number of inquiries from teachers asking for help resigning. If the union can figure out a plan now, she says, that may help avoid mass resignations, which would force schools to go entirely remote. It is far better for our students and families to be able to plan on an inconvenience like that than it would be for the whole system to stop functioning, Teal said. In Southfield, outside Detroit, the school district alerted parents on October 31st, a Sunday, that it would go remote that Friday, and then every Friday until February. Christina Morgan, whose daughter is an eighth grader at University Middle School Academy, said she found out through social media. A single mother who works for the Wayne County court system, Morgan now spends the beginning of every week asking family members to watch her daughter, Kennedy. If she cannot find anyone, she will take the day off from work, which she says reflects poorly at the office and makes her feel like a burden to her family. It's very difficult already being a single parent, period, she said. But when you have your life figured out based on your child being in school during certain hours, and when I have to scramble to find childcare outside of those hours or to ask around, it's frustrating. Morgan could leave her teenage daughter at home alone, but was worried that she would get distracted by her phone or the internet instead of paying attention to school. Research shows that disruptions during the pandemic led to students falling behind in math and reading, and students who were most affected by the crisis were already behind. Reynolds, the single mother from Detroit, said her son, once a straight-A math student, tested 2 grade levels behind when he returned to the classroom this year. Last Friday, Theo Egebrecht, 17, a senior in the arts track at Cass Technical High School in Detroit, did not have any at-home supplies for 2 of his arts classes that day. He said his science teacher did not show up for online class. Instead, Egebrecht spent several hours doing chores, petting his cat, and scrolling through TikTok. I'm a senior. This is one of my last years of education, he said. It's nerve-wracking to miss out on that. Schools have not yet reached winter break, but many teachers are already burned out. It seems that many parents and students are as well. Kisselman recalls the moment her daughter asked for help with an assignment. She was just in and out of the living room because her anxiety level was so high, Kisselman said. She's like, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to learn on my own? Kisselman did not have an answer. I finally just looked at her and said, just don't do anything today, Kisselman said. Just go into the bedroom and just do whatever, but don't mess with school today. This next article comes from BBC News, and it's entitled, Some Schools Struggling to Stay Open as COVID Cases Rise, by Hannah Richardson, a BBC News education reporter. Schools in some high infection areas in England are struggling to stay fully open due to rising COVID rates, a head teacher's leader says. Association of School and College Leaders General Secretary Jeff Barton says he knows of schools which have had 25% of staff absent for several weeks, and there were cases where public health officials were telling schools to switch to remote learning. Ministers have said they will do everything to keep schools open. But on Monday, Education Secretary Nadhim Zahawi stopped short of guaranteeing that no schools would be forced to close. This next section is called COVID Absence Up. In Scotland, First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has said new measures are needed to stop the spread of COVID, but she is insisting schools will not close early. In England, the latest data shows 236,000 pupils were out of school for COVID-related reasons on Thursday, December 9th. This is an increase of 13% on the last time the snapshot survey of school attendance was taken 2 weeks earlier. Overall, 2.9% of pupils were out of school last Thursday, compared to 2.6% the last time the figures were published. Some 3,000 pupils were out of school as a result of school closures. The next section is called Remote Learning. Mr. Barton told BBC Radio 4's Today program, "Listening to the speculation in the news, and certainly the emails I've been getting from members, you were getting some pockets of very severe low attendance, partly young people, partly staff. One school has emailed me this morning saying 25% of staff have been off for 3 weeks. You can imagine if you can't then get supply teachers, that becomes very difficult to maintain the quality of education. He also spoke of a primary school and a secondary in the same academy trust in the Bury St. Edmunds area of Suffolk, which has moved to remote learning. That wasn't a decision at the whim of a head teacher. That wasn't someone saying, "We are going to close the school so Christmas can come early." That was on public health advice. What we are getting is a national narrative, quite rightly, that we want to do everything we can to keep young people in school. But on the ground, in particular areas, such as Bury St. Edmunds, public health are saying actually because of infection rates, we are recommending that young people should move to remote learning. In Ainslie, North Wales, many pupils will end the term with blended learning as coronavirus levels soar within the county. On Friday, the island had the highest case rate in Wales. Over the previous 7 days, Ainslie's incidence rate had risen to 840.9 per 100,000 people. And pupils in Denbighshire will end face-to-face lessons on Friday, December 17th, and learn from home until term ends officially on December 21st. At Ash Green Community Primary in Halifax, a fifth of staff were absent for COVID-related reasons recently, and this sort of case rate was replicated among the pupils. In two classes, for 2 weeks there were only about 60% of the children, due to confirmed or suspected cases, says head teacher Mongo Shepherd. One of the most difficult things is that you don't know what your staffing structure will be. The staffing plan I had in place this morning was different from what I had when I went to bed. Family support worker at the school, Amber, says she has had quite a few parents, quote, really frightened about the new Omicron variant. This next section is called January Reopening. Barry Reed, head teacher of a school in Essex, says, quote, "We have been hit hard with children and staff off. On top, agencies do not have any staff to cover." Devon head teacher Paul Gosling said it is tough to keep things going, but he is more concerned about January. "If we have more staff falling ill, then it could be difficult to keep the school fully open. And some parents are concerned about rising case rates and what they see as lack of general mitigations in place to reduce the spread of infection." A mother from Southwest London, Claire, told the BBC how one-year group had 15% off with COVID and bubble groups had returned in some years. The next section is called Parents Concerned. She said, "Still no masks in classrooms, but the, quote, hygiene theater of more sanitizer. What will it take for the government to mandate masks in classrooms?" Mother of three, Bernadette Quinn, has one child at St. Chad's Catholic Primary in Bishop Auckland, where she says there are fantastic safety procedures in place. She said it was vitally important that schools reopen in January. "I work full-time. I have three children, and trying to educate three children at home is virtually impossible." Andy Boyd, who has two children at the school, said he was concerned about the Omicron variant. "When your kids are in an environment where there are lots of people in a small room, you've got to be concerned, haven't you? I know it's a very good school, though, and they do all they can to protect them." Paul Whiteman, General Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers, said schools need clear and consistent advice from central and local government now so that they can respond appropriately. "Over the last few days, we have heard from our members that there has been a significant jump in COVID cases in schools, amongst both staff and pupils, as the new variant has started to spread. Some have told us that this has been the hardest term of the whole pandemic." He added, "Everyone is concerned about how this will play out over the next few weeks and the implications for January. No one wants to see the sort of disruption to education that we experienced last winter." This last article comes from K-12 Dive, and it's entitled, "Why Student Data Remains at Risk and What Educators Are Doing to Protect It." Outdated laws, abundance of state rules, and increase in ed tech tools add to the difficulty in protecting students' personal data. This was published on December 14, 2021, and it was written by Kara Arundel. In 1998, when the World Wide Web was an exciting novelty, several government agencies and advocates raised alarms about the unregulated collection of children's personal information from website owners. A Federal Trade Commission survey conducted at the time, when about 14% of children used the internet at home or at school, found 89% of websites marketed for children had collected personal information directly from young users. Most troubling, the FTC wrote in a report, was the ease with which predators could communicate with children in chat rooms or online forums. These deep concerns led to the passage of laws to safeguard children's personal online data, with the aim to prevent the unintended exposure of the details of a child's life and to keep kids safe. But more than 20 years later, educators, parents, researchers, and lawmakers are continuing to sound alarms about the vulnerability of children's online personal data, as nearly every child is now able to access the internet from home, school, or a smartphone in their pocket. Federal laws and regulations have brought oversight and the promotion of best practices, as well as partnerships between ed tech companies and school systems. But some of those laws are now outdated or misinterpreted, critics say. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, for example, was enacted in 2000 and last updated in 2013, just as social media really took off. Since then, most state education departments and legislatures have developed stricter policies to further protect children's online privacy. According to the Data Quality Campaign, 45 states and Washington, D.C. enacted new student data privacy laws between 2014 and 2020. Yet while school systems are required to protect children's online data, at the same time they are encouraged or mandated to collect and keep a vast amount of information about each student. These data points include students' academic standing, images and videos, creative content, discipline referrals, social-emotional and physical well-being, special education records, socioeconomic status, and much more. And often, school systems are putting their trust into third-party edtech providers to safeguard the student information. Although monitoring for online threats against students and data breaches has become more sophisticated over the years, some privacy advocates worry about the potential for inequitable tracking of student online activity and the security of so much data. A survey of district IT leaders from the Consortium for School Networking names privacy and security of student data as the number two top technology priority after cybersecurity. In fact, the management and protection of student online data was a system already under strain and conflicting missions, and then in 2020, when the pandemic forced every student to learn from home virtually, things got even more complex. This next section is called Safeguarding Student Data. Nancy Burns has been IT director of Fairfield Public Schools in Connecticut since 2000. Over the years, she's seen technology evolve from computer labs students visited a few times a week to a situation where every student in grades 3 to 12 and many staff have school-issued devices. And we're going to have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.